Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 41 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me as always is my wonderful, amazing hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
Hello, Weird. I am speaking to you from underwater.
I hope you're okay.
Well, yes, all Floridians have vestigial gills. You see, it's been raining for over 24 hours here in Florida.
This is the best gag ever. Is it cold, too, or are you guys getting this polar vortex?
Well, it's Florida cold. I couldn't do that to my cheek for much longer. It's like 55 degrees. I mean, it wasn't as cold as last week when it was like, I think, 45. But still, you know, that's pretty chilly. And so 55 degrees with a wind and rain is just nasty.
Oh, it's unpleasant.
Oh, yeah, highly unpleasant.
Ugh.
And, I mean, we're used to all-day rains because it happens a lot when we have tropical storms, hurricanes, things like that. But it's rare for Florida to have an all-day, 24-hour rain with no big storm attached to it. And this was one of them. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, you wake up on Sunday. Oh, it's raining. And it just rains all day and all day and all day. And it's still raining. I think it rained for like 26 hours.
Oh, man. Did you start gathering up two of each of the animals?
Well, you know, there's a reason I'm a prepper.
Best response ever.
Thank you. But yeah, fortunately, we don't live in a floodplain. Mm-hmm. So
that is good, especially given how low Florida is. That's
yeah, what a lot of people don't seem to realize is that about a good chunk of Florida, I mean, between a third to a half of Florida, is just basically a couple of feet of topsoil over sandbar. Mm-hmm. Really. And that's why, even though we're a very tropical sort of state, we are very dry. And that's why most summers we have a fire alert. And they tell us, you know, don't start fires, don't do the fireworks, don't do this, don't do that. Because all of the undergrowth that grows during the rainy months of winter and spring, you know, okay, it's getting that from all the rain, and then the rain sort of dries up during the summer, and all that stuff just dies, and it's just tinder, because the soil doesn't retain the water. I mean, we don't have basements, and the reason we don't have these basements is because we hit, I know this is going to sound contradictory here, but if you dig down only a couple of feet, you will hit the water table.
Yep.
But at the same time, it's not enough water to actually maintain a lot of the foliage. I mean, the trees can get down deep, but the plants, they don't get down deep enough. So it's just at that sweet spot, really. The trees can get deep enough to hit that water table, but the plants don't. And so without the constant rain, they just dry up and die. And it's really weird that you can have what is felt to be a very rainy state, and yet we are, you know, fire hazard for 3 to 6 months out of the year. And that's exactly what happened in, I think it was 1998, when I think every county except the Keys was on fire. It was really nasty. I don't remember if it was El Nino or La Nina, because I don't remember which one does what. But there was one that just brought in lots and lots and lots of rain during the spring, and all the little plants went, oh, yay, water, and they blossomed and flourished. And then the summer came in, and the Nina went away, and just they all died. And then one spark somewhere. And Florida is the lightning strike capital of the United States, if not the world. And so, you know, you get the thunderstorms, you get the lightning, just goes up like tinder. And so 98 was really, really bad. The fires got so bad, they were producing their own wind and driving the embers forward. It was literally a firestorm. And, you know, when the burning embers actually leap the intercoastal waterway and start burning on the barrier islands between the intercoastal waterway and the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah, that's really serious.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the phenomenon you're talking about, though, is also the fact that because it's so sandy, you're very well drained. So unless the water's coming down, it's getting whisked away. Because we actually have that problem in my yard. Is I have some gutters that drain, that would drain onto my patio. So instead, we had them dig the gutter lines underneath the patio and out into the lawn, and they dug what's called a dry well, which is essentially just a large bed of crushed stone, and they put a little topsoil over the top of it and plant grass on it. Well, that grass dies like the moment we stop having rain. Like as soon as like spring goes to summer, it just turns brown because the water just gets whisked away and it just dries out. All the lawn around it's just fine because it's got, you know, nice thick soil, but that sand and gravel just pulls the water away from the roots.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope it warms up a little bit more for when we get down to Florida, because I'm sitting down here wrapped up in a blanket. Just, it's cold.
Well, what temperature is it there now?
Oh, it's like 20 degrees, so it's warmed up a bit.
Well, hey, if you came down right now, it would be a 30-degree improvement, so...
That is true. It actually probably would feel pretty awesome, but, like, I want it to be friggin' 90. I just want to be just walking around buck naked. Going, I'm warm. I like it.
Considering how pale you are, you would burn.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it'd be awful. It'd be a mess.
You'd be a lobster.
So, Aaron... Speaking of me traveling, you were telling me that you've got some travel plans coming up.
Yes, I do. Thank you for the reminder. So, for our fans who are in the western parts of the country, I will be a panelist at the Life, the Universe, and Everything convention in Provo, Utah, from February 14th through the 16th. And a quick primer for people who don't know what LTUE is. It is essentially a convention for writers who can go to panels who are staffed by subject matter experts so that they can learn about a particular subject. So if you don't know anything about guns and you want to write intelligently about guns, you go to the gun use in fiction panel or something like that, where you get people probably like Larry Correa, someone who has done a lot of shooting, and they will sit there on the panel and people will ask them questions and there will be a back and forth, and hopefully the writers leave going, oh, hey, I learned some things. So I was asked to be a panelist, and I will be appearing on three panels, one each day. And so if you are in Utah, or you can get to Provo, I'd like for you to attend. You can sit in on one of my panels. It's not just going to be me. There are going to be other people. But come in, say hi, get a hug. I really don't know how difficult it is to buy entrance to the con, you know, because I'm a guest. I don't have to pay. Anyway, Thursday at 3 p.m., I will be on the panel of Fundamentals of Self-Defense Law. Gosh, go figure. On Friday at 1 p.m., I will be a panelist on the Oppressing a Gender, Race, or Species, which is it's a fictional, you know, discussion on how a society might oppress or enslave a gender, race, or species. And you can probably see where I'm coming from there, because, you know, I don't like playing the victim card, but the queer community has been oppressed historically, and so I've got some understanding. And, well, okay, here's what happened in reality. Let's extrapolate. My Saturday panel, I really have no idea how I got on this, because I didn't list myself as a subject matter expert. I listed myself just as an enthusiast, and I guess I didn't have enough people to staff it. And this panel is called Warfare in the Age of Drones and Robots.
Okay.
Which, yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to love to be on the panel. So the topic here is, we have unmanned drones and remote-controlled robots to aid us in our fighting endeavors. How do these guys with 100-year-old Enfield bolt-action rifles still stand a chance? Well, hey, this is just a high-tech version of... How do you gun owners think you're going to stand up against the might of the United States war machine? Mm-hmm. AKA, how did the Viet Cong fight us to a standstill in Vietnam? Mm-hmm. You know, how did the Mujahideen fight the Russians to a standstill in Afghanistan? So, you know, I've got some thoughts on this. I don't know how good a job I'll do, but yeah, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you'll have fun. So, I mean, so long as you don't, I mean, you've got two options. One is lay your cards on the table, or two, go full the sign language guy at the Nelson Mandela funeral and just start claiming that you're building power armor in your basement. And yes, I understand you're in Florida and you don't have a basement. That makes it better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really what I was going to do was I was going to talk about the ethical implications currently of drone warfare, because we have killer robots, but the kill switch is, and there is a hard law for it somewhere. I don't know where it exists, but right now, even though we have drones that can kill human beings, they don't have that autonomy. A human being must make the decision to fire the missile to execute the kill code. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting ethical question debate in there somewhere. Plus, I mean, we're talking about drones. That's going to really easily lead to facial recognition. And I have all sorts of thoughts on facial recognition because of being trans. And so I can bring, I think, some interesting viewpoints to the table. Probably not what people were thinking, but you know, hey, all right, you want to evade a drone. Well, how are the drones going to track you? Well, they probably want to track you with facial recognition. Well, here are the things you can change and here are the things you can't, et cetera, et cetera. It'll be interesting. I don't know if it'll be fascinating interesting or train wreck interesting, but I'll do my best to make it fascinating. So, yeah, if you are in Provo, Utah, the weekend of Valentine's Day, come on by.
Oh, man, this just brings back to me as I'm bummed that the U.S. military never went forward to. I don't even know if they had an operation name for it, but where they were going to dump the FP-45 Liberator pistols into occupied France and see what that would do against the Germans. Like, I would love to have seen historically how that, if that would have worked out exactly how we planned it. I can only imagine it would have. Is the idea being, of course, for those that aren't familiar, is I believe it was the Department of Defense or Department of War, whatever it was called in World War II, went through and told GM, I think it was just for like 2 months, they stopped making cars in one of their facilities and just started banging out these crappy little sheet metal pistols. They were smooth bore, single shot, striker fired 45 caliber pistols. And they were just single shot. They had room in the butt. There was a hole in the butt to hold like three more cartridges. And smoothbore, so you couldn't shoot more than, you know, probably across the room sort of distance. And then by that point in time, the round would be tumbling. But the idea being you could airdrop these things by the millions into occupied France. And if the Germans captured them, what did they gain? They got a couple of rounds of 45 ACP ammunition and a really, really crappy pistol. But if the peasants and the partisans got a hold of it, well, geez, now you've got this guy who's going about his business, bringing his cheese to market, and there's a German guard there. And all of a sudden, out from under his rucksack comes this little steel pistol, and pop, in the back of the head, there he goes, and now you've got an MP44.
And you hand your Liberator pistol off to your buddy in the resistance, who does the same thing.
Well, yeah, handing, even, probably just throw the thing in the dirt, because actually, Phil Schreier actually fired one of the NRA Museum Liberators, and I think he fired it like between three and five times, and then had somebody run over the thing with the micrometer, and it was already starting to go out of spec. Like, these, you could fire them multiple times, you probably shouldn't. They were literally disposable guns, and just, I got to imagine that work, again, for the same reason why, yeah, the Vietnam War just went the way it did, the Russians in Afghanistan. I mean, the whole how long we were fighting the insurgency in Iraq. It's absolutely asymmetrical warfare. And yet, at the same time, well, it was giving us a whole lot of trouble. But on another angle that I think we could go on to is you were talking about defensive gun use laws as one of your panels.
Yes.
And there is a very interesting case that happened the other day here in Massachusetts.
Oh, yes. I saw that. Wow.
This story just brings up like so much to talk about, and on multiple angles too, which it makes it really fascinating for me. So evidently these two people are driving down the Mass Pike. That's I-90 for those who want to look on Google Maps. And one of the cars sideswipes the other one. So they swap a little paint and they both pull over to the side of the road. And I guess one of them comes out and wants to exchange information. And the other guy, I guess, doesn't want to come out. This is a developing story, so some stuff might be wrong. But one guy is out of his car talking to the other guy, trying to get insurance information. And they start arguing. The guy that's out of his car is an older gentleman. He's in his, I believe, 60s. And he, for some reason, reaches in and gets a water bottle. It sounds like it's more of a thermos. It's a metal flask of some sort.
Well, I mean, they still do have that. Like Clean Canteen offers water bottles in, I think it's stainless steel.
Yeah.
Might be aluminum. Not sure.
Either way, he has a metal beverage container that belongs to the guy that's in the car. I really don't know exactly what's going on with this, but what happens next is pretty clear because there's video of it. The guy tries to run him down and he pulls a TJ Hooker and jumps on the hood of the car and is riding down the highway at speeds up to 70 miles an hour. Evidently, I don't know if this is done while driving or all that, but somebody sees this and they have a Massachusetts LTC and are carrying. And again, the story's really conflicting. I'm not 100% sure if he pulls his gun on him while they're driving or if he blocks the guy in and gets him to stop and pulls his gun on him, but essentially gets the guy to surrender.
Yeah, I had the same question, and I read the article, and I could not find how he got the guy to pull over.
Yeah, and what's interesting is actually just we just went and grabbed pizza for dinner, and at the local pizza place, they have a big TV that they're just pretty much always showing the either local news or the local sports game, and that story came up, and my wife and daughter were both with me, and they were talking, and I didn't want to immediately just go, shush, I'm watching the news. So I might have missed it, but really the talk of the lawful gun owner is really getting downplayed. I mean, he definitely did not get arrested or stopped or questioned or facing anything.
Which is surprising, right? Because neither of the two people involved in the road rage incident were 100% in the right. Obviously, the guy who tried to run down the old man and continued down the road with him on his hood was most in the wrong. However, the older man really should have jumped out of the way rather than trying to jump onto his hood and smash in the guy's windshield. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
And also, how is he taking the other guy's stuff? Like that's one of those like ones that really gets me scratching my head. Is the everything seems all right until all of a sudden he's got his hands on a drink container on property that he pulled out of the other guy's car.
Exactly. Yeah. He committed theft in a lot of ways. Well, I don't know the details of the sideswipe, but in terms of the interaction, he committed the first wrong. So, yeah, neither of them really covered themselves in glory. Now, that said, I am glad that the lawful concealed carrier intervened to prevent a tragedy, although I have some concern because that really wasn't his business, and it could have ended badly. And there was actually some comments on the article about how the gun user interfered when he shouldn't have, and how he could have been arrested for, what was it, brandishing or threatening or something like that. And I'm really surprised that he got involved at all.
I think the reason why he didn't face any trouble is because I think the police immediately saw that his heart was in the right place. Whatever lines that he might be straddling between, you know, between good gun use and bad gun use was ephemeral enough that I think they realized that by them bringing that guy in as well, they're probably getting themselves into way more trouble than it's worth. The big thing to take away from this is both men are currently facing charges. The man who was driving the car is facing more charges than the man who was, you know, almost or was struck by the car.
including elder abuse, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, they've got the little additional thing is the fact that he was doing it to a much older gentleman.
Which is probably why the carrier wasn't arrested, because, all right, you look at the situation, there is an older man on the hood of a car being driven by a younger man.
In excess
speed. You're automatically going to think that the old man is a victim.
Yeah. Because you even get the idea of I always thought about that with the TJ Hooker TV show, the guy's tried to run you down and you jumped on the hood. All right, I get that part. But at what point do you just not roll off the side of the hood and, you know, hit the pavement? But when you're going 70 miles an hour and you're on a major highway, the chances of somebody else running over you once you get off the car is fairly high. So
I'd be worried about the driver hitting the brakes and throwing me off.
Mm. It's a messy situation. And that's the big thing is you always say, don't draw your gun for someone you don't want to go to jail for. And so when you see two strangers engaging in something, now, to be fair, if you see two strangers engaging in something, and I think that's where this comes in, and it looks like one of them is going to kill the other one, then that might be an instance where intervening might be okay. But again, still, you don't know where this has come from. You don't know where this is going. You don't know who these people are. Again, both of these guys have some, you know, have some taint on them for bad behavior. And to identify who exactly is the good guy or who exactly is the bad guy in this situation is up for the courts, and it's very nebulous at this point in time. And so at the same time, as a general rule, we say don't get involved. Don't get involved. Use it to protect you and yours. You're not the sheepdog to do a callback to the previous episodes. It turned out it worked out in this guy's favor, at least as far as I know. But also, who knows? It's Massachusetts. He could end up getting his permit revoked the next time he goes to renewal, because they can do that.
Ugh.
So, Aaron, were you at SHOT Show last week?
You weird. Oh, jeez. No, I was not at SHOT Show. I want to be at SHOT Show, but I never get to go to SHOT Show because it's expensive as hell to get there, and I can't justify the expense. And just rub a little salt in the wound, why don't you?
I wasn't at SHOT Show either. That's the funny line. Ryan and I did a SHOT Show after Matt's show for Handgun Radio, and that was the start of it. So weird. Were you at SHOT Show? No, I wasn't. Were you at SHOT Show? No. Let's talk about it.
One of these days, though, one of these days, I'm going to go.
I don't know. I've heard mixed things about it, but...
Okay, I too have heard mixed things about it. I've heard mixed things about it from Oleg, who has said that if you've been to the NRA annual meeting, you've seen the best of SHOT Show. Mm-hmm. I just want to go once for no other reason, because I've never been to Vegas. I want to visit Vegas. I watched a lot of CSI. I want to see the modern day Sodom and Gomorrah before it gets destroyed by God. I think it'd be really cool. Oh, and also, doesn't like the end of SHOT Show run into the beginning of the Adult Video Network Awards, or maybe vice versa?
They run they run concurrently or something like that. So, yeah.
Okay.
You could go. You could go shoot some guns and then meet Ron Jeremy.
But for those of us who didn't get to go, social media was just awash in all sorts of things. And one of the things that I thought was very cool and I want but cannot afford is that the Tippmann Armory has produced a miniature Gatling gun in 9mm. And yes, it takes Glock magazines.
That's just so cool.
It's just so cool. I mean, okay, it's a little too big to be cute, but it is just, you know, miniature and awesome.
I think it's just the right size to be cute, especially if you've seen like a 45-70 Gatling gun. Like those things are gigantic, and like you need a trailer to move it around. It's just a big old pile of brass and steel.
Yeah.
But this thing is just little teeny tiny. It's on like wagon wheels, and yeah. And it's $3,000, but when you look at like the number of widgets and moving pieces, and just it's an amazing piece of craftsmanship, and that's actually doesn't seem too unreasonable a price.
No, it's what I find interesting is that it's not a machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
Through some, I can't even really say weird interpretation of the law. I mean more like the law is weird because only one bullet is fired out of a barrel per revolution. It's not a machine gun.
Yes, essentially how my understanding of the law works is that if you are to spin that crank on the back, you'll hear it go click, 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 click of the firing pins dropping as the rounds are chambered and ejected and fired, et cetera, et cetera. But every click is a trigger pull. And that's actually the reason why we also have like trigger cranks and various Gatling action stuff. Like I know there was a kit where you could take like two AKs and run a crank onto between the two of them. And as you're turning the crank, it'll fire left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. And it's every time that ratchet goes around and makes a click. And that is your trigger pull. Our friend McThag is asking to see the documentation. I'm actually curious to see this. I know, but I've heard again, but the moment you take an electric drill and attach it to that, suddenly the trigger of the electric drill becomes the trigger. And then you're going click, click, click with one pull of the trigger.
You know, I'm reminded of Judaism and the whole, you cannot turn on the lights if you're an observant Jew on the Sabbath, because turning on the light switch is the equivalent of building a fire back in the day. And back in the day, building a fire took a lot of work, and you weren't supposed to work on the Sabbath. It's that same sort of, I don't really know what to call it, but it is a very fine legal point. And actually, I would love for David to address this, the way some gun laws are actually, you know, you can approach them through the rabbinical logical construct. I'm getting it wrong. But there is, for example, somewhere in the Talmud where they're trying to illustrate the thinking about the story of, you know, there are two burglars who come down the chimney, and one has soot on his face and one doesn't. And one burglar looks at the other and who washes it. And the way he explains it, it's one of those, you know, it can be the burglar with the clean face washes his face, the one with the dirty face washes his face, both of them wash their face, none wash their face. And it's just one of those, it doesn't make any sense until you hear the reasoning behind it. And I feel that a lot of gun laws are sort of like that, where you just have to, I don't know, just absorb the whole context and just kind of go with it. So, all right, we've gone completely off track with that. What did you see from SHOT Show that really tickled your fancy?
Well, I saw the Gatling gun. I'm glad you mentioned that. Another one, the one that got like the most drama on Facebook and the like, was the Franklin Armory. They was it last year or was it 2 years ago? I think it was last year. They had their Reformation non. It's a gun. It's a rifle, but doesn't impart spin. They had come up with some interesting ideas on it. A lot of people were curious. It's certainly a niche gun, but essentially they came up with what is a short-barreled rifle, but because the rifling on it doesn't impart spin, it kind of fits outside of the realm of the ATF's rules, and it's much like those tiny shotguns. So it is a short-barreled gun that is rifled, but not considered a rifle, and so therefore it can have a shoulder stock. And neat, cool that they did that. But I felt that what they brought out this year was really, really cool, which they're calling it the Providence. And it is essentially, it's a 9mm AR carbine type thing. But it's not semi-auto. It is essentially kind of like a double action revolver. It's got a big, long trigger pull, and as you pull the trigger, it brings the bolt back, and then when the bolt reaches the end of its travel, it comes forward, strips around off the chamber, and essentially works like an open bolt submachine gun, where the firing pin is fixed, and so it essentially slam fires the round, but it's also got an AR-style rotating bolt on it. So the action slam fires, but it slam fires while it's in full lock and it stays closed until you reset the trigger and bring that bolt back again with another trigger pull. And so essentially it's like shooting your double action revolver, except for it's pulling rounds out of a magazine. And they originally designed that for like the EU and Australia and places like that, where they are heavily restricted on semi-autos. But they also said, yeah, this will also work in Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, etc.
Now, didn't this company have a bit of a spat with InRange?
They did. So InRange, and I've heard some, actually just before the show started, I watched an interview Hank Strange did asking about their kerfuffle. But essentially, so I'm going to keep it somewhat vague without me pointing accusations, because I Franklin Armory, I like what they're doing. I like that they're thinking outside the box. InRange, I like what they do as well. They're also thinking outside the box type people.
Who doesn't like Gun Jesus?
Exactly. Exactly. And for a while, my daughter had a wicked crush on Carl. Yeah. Like, there would be times where Ian would be talking. She was like, no, I want to see the other guy. Like, okay, I like Carl too. But essentially, they talked to somebody from Franklin Armory about the Reformation, the straight cut rifling AR style gun. And they really put his feet to the fire. And from my personal opinion, I don't think he did a great job at explaining the gun. I think the gun is a neat gun in itself, but you really need to frame it just the right way, because it's a football bat. It's a weird gun. Because essentially, I mean, you're making a rifle, but the round is going to start tumbling like outside of like 15 feet. And then, so they showed up at Franklin Armory again. They wanted to see this new gun, because everyone hearing about this new gun. And they were essentially told that they were under direct instructions not to talk to InRange. According to Franklin Armory, the next part would have been, they never said this to them because, according to them, Carl immediately started getting upset and calling them out on being jerks for specifically having an order against specifically on them. But essentially the idea was they would be given an interview, but only with the president of Franklin Armory, because he wanted to make sure that if any tough technical questions like last time were asked, he would be able to field them, which makes sense. Especially when you see that interview, in the fact that the guy that they were interviewing doesn't sound like he's a bad guy, doesn't sound like that, but it sounds like he might not have been as entrenched in that rifle and why that rifle is an important thing to be made. But either way, there's some fingers pointed on either direction. I'm just gonna say I like them both. I hope it all works out, and I think that gun's really, really cool, and I'd like to see more of that, because again, it's not semi-automatic. It is essentially like a double action revolver. And so because of that, it can be like, I mean, I've got a Mossberg 590 that is a shotgun. It's got a bayonet lug. I can put a folding stock on it, pistol grip. I could do all sorts of stuff that is verboten for a semi-auto rifle here in Massachusetts. But because it's a pump action shotgun, no, it doesn't matter. I could do as much goofiness as I want to that. And this would essentially fall into that as well, with the only restriction being the magazines would still have to be Massachusetts compliant, being either pre-ban or 10 round or less.
So have you heard about the new ammunition that debuted at SHOT?
Which one was that?
Seismic.
Yes.
Plus M ammunition.
I have.
All right, so Seismic is being billed as Plus M instead of Plus P. And the idea here is that, well, one of the few things I remember from physics is the formula how force equals mass times acceleration. And with Plus P ammunition, you increase the powder charge to increase the acceleration, therefore creating the force. Well, in this case, they're increasing the mass in order to get that same impact. And with Seismic, and this is billed as self-defense ammo, mind you. It's not a round nose for the range. They have jacketed hollow point, 9mm, 185 grains. Now, for those who don't shoot 9mm, because Weird doesn't, standard round nose 9mm is 115 grain. The defensive ammo I carry is 124 grain, although I have seen up to 147 grain for jacketed hollow points. This is 185. And they have listed as coming soon 325 grain, 45 JHP.
Which, by the way, the first thing I immediately did was I went to the 50GI Wikipedia page, which is the goofy, oversized 50 caliber 1911 Guncrafter Industries created. And essentially, it's a rebated rim 50 caliber round so that it fits on a 45 breech face, but will fit into a slightly bigger 1911. The bullet for the 50 GI, their heaviest load is 300 grains. So this is a gigantic 45, and they have no other data. I don't know how, according to their, I think the it's going just subsonic. So it's like, I think it was like 850, 800, 890 feet per second for the, for that 185 grain 9mm. I don't know how
actually
slow.
I've got it in front of me, and Seismic Ammo says, whoops, we goofed and didn't have velocity listed. We are seeing around 950 feet per second.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that is a ton of speed. I mean, according to their website, they use a slower burning powder, so I'm curious if it might be very barrel length subjective. Again, whenever I'm a size queen. I carry 45. I carry 230 grain plus P 45. Like, I want the biggest bullet out there. I like the mass in that equation. Acceleration absolutely produces a lot of power, but with the pistol rounds, you're really getting most of the power from the mass of the bullet.
And with it being subsonic, it is suppressor friendly.
That is correct. But when somebody comes out with a quote-unquote magic bullet, I'm always very skeptical. And there's been a ton of magic bullets that have come out that have turned out to not work as advertised. So I'm very curious to see how this works and if it's good. Another also thing I have is when you're dealing with a bullet that is that drastically different, are they going through all the research to make sure that these hollow points are going to expand at the velocities that they're going to be presented at?
Well, see, funny you bring that up, because I am fascinated by ballistics, but I don't understand math. As David pointed out, however long ago, Lucky Gunner Lab has this extensive amount of data on defensive ammunition field tests where they shoot it into the block of gelatin, and they give you the average penetration, the average rate of expansion. They give you all sorts of hard data. And what I did was I commented, hey, you know, I would really love to see this being given to Lucky Gunner where the lab boys can run their tests on it. Mm-hmm. And someone affiliated with the company says, you know, I could probably do that. Do you know anyone at Lucky Gunner? And I go, I do, my ammo pimp, Anthony. Here, let me give you his information. And I don't know anything else. Hopefully, the person from Seismic has contacted Anthony at Lucky Gunner, and they're going to get it in a shipment, and they can test it, because I love this sort of detail. I really want it. And as soon as we get it, we'll post it here. But yeah, I really want to see all of that. Well, you want the crunchy numbers. I just want to gawk at the various pictures.
Well, I'm just also impressed that they're immediately getting the ball rolling with third-party testing, because that says to me of the, all in, show me your cards, is the, no, we've shot some ballistic gel. We've played some games. We've run the numbers. So that's good, because, again, doing strange ammo might be bad if you don't do your due diligence, but if you do your due diligence, it could turn out awesome.
Right. I remember it was a couple of NRAs ago, there was the ammo from Polycase. I don't remember what it was, where it was some sort of frangible round nose looking thing with divots, mm-hmm. cut into it with the channels, and the idea was it loads like a round nose, but when it encounters flesh, the cutouts, it sort of acts like a propeller cutting into flesh. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, that's really interesting. And I couldn't see ballistic data done on it anywhere. And so I just assume that because I couldn't find it, they weren't sending it out for a lot of testing. And it has really never made it anywhere since. So, you know, if Lucky Gunner doesn't test the stuff, I don't trust it. Because, you know, I don't do math. I have people for that. And yeah, I agree. The fact that they are willing to send this out says a whole lot of good things.
Yeah, that's awesome. The Egghead returns, now with another piece of technological gear that will do wonders for your prepper kit, the Buck Boost Converter.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the General Purpose Egghead segment. This week, we're going to divert a little bit from guns to talk about another little useful piece of kit I think that every prepper should have if they depend on electronic devices in their preps. It is called a buck boost converter, specifically one with a constant current and constant voltage function. So that's a bit of a mouthful. So what does it do? What it is it's a little device that will take any input voltage and convert it to whatever output voltage you set it up for. The constant current, constant voltage models also have a maximum current function, and that function allows you to set a maximum amount of current that the device will provide before it starts lowering the voltage. This is useful for setting it up to be safer in case there's a short circuit, and it also makes them ideal for charging batteries. In fact, usually when you see them, they're being sold as either lithium-ion battery chargers or as LED light strip power modules. So how they work is they basically consist of a transformer. It's the wire-wrapped donut-shaped bit in the middle, and a couple transistors and a little microcontroller, and a few capacitors. So the little microcontroller monitors the voltage at the input and output, and it controls the transistors. The transistors are basically little electronic switches that can flick on and off several thousand times a second. And the transformer in the middle has got two windings on it, one on the input and one on the output. And when current flows through either the input or the output, it creates a magnetic field in that little transformer. And this field stores a lot of energy. So if you leave the input open all the time, so a lot of current flows through it, and then you turn the output on and off very quickly and kind of flicker or pulse it, the energy gets built up in that magnetic field when the output is off, and then when the output is turned on, it's released. Since you have a little bit of stored energy that's in that magnetic field that gets released, the output voltage is higher than the input voltage. If you flip it around and pulse the input, you would step the voltage down. So the microcontroller controls how fast the input and output transistors flicker and measures the voltage and regulates it so that the output voltage is always constant at whatever you set it at. Now, this flickering on and off of these switches means your output voltage is a little choppy. The voltage actually bounces up and down as those switches rise and fall. So they also have capacitors built in. These are the little can-shaped devices on the circuit board. Usually they're blue. These act like tiny little batteries, and they will absorb that little high voltage spike and then release a little bit of again when the voltage drops back down. So they help to smooth out that ripple somewhat. It doesn't completely get rid of it, but it does help. So that's all well and good, but what are you going to use these for? Why should I have one? Well, I find they are great for making my vital electronic devices completely omnivorous. I can feed from almost anything with one of these. The way I've got mine set up is I have a small Tupperware container, one of the little ones that's designed to hold sauce or something like that. And I have the regulator set up inside there with those little Anderson power pole connections I mentioned earlier on the input and output. I've got the voltage settings set to what my ham radio battery needs. And the current rating is set to a reasonable amount that's, about as much as my battery is comfortable taking at any given time. If I'm in my car, I have a little cigarette lighter adapter to power pole, and I plug that in, and I plug it into the buck boost regulator, and it'll charge my battery off of my car, boosting up the 11 or so volts from the car battery up to the 14 that my radio needs. If I'm at home, I can take a laptop charger and cut off the tip and put power poles on that, plug that into the wall, and step down the 20 or so volts from the laptop adapter down to the 14 my radio wants. I could also, if I happen to find an old 6-volt lantern battery, plug in a little Anderson power pole to alligator clip adapter, stick the alligator clips on that, and charge my battery off of that. If I'm at my grandma's house and she's got a little wall plug-in adapter for a phone that hasn't been used since 1996, I can cut the little tip off of that. Any source of DC power. And really, there's DC power all around you. Little battery backups or uninterruptible power supplies, car batteries, even a handful of AA's I could put into a little 4 or 5 cell battery pack and use those. And they also work pretty well for hooking up to solar panels. And they're not just limited to ham radio use either. You can get one and set it up for 5 volts, which is what your phone needs, and a little USB adapter. And you could charge your phone off of any of these sources. Or if you have any other kind of a battery, you can just adjust it to whatever voltage you need and set the current to whatever current the battery can handle. You can even set it up to charge rechargeable AA's if you have to. It's not the most efficient. Constant current, constant voltage isn't the fastest way to charge those, so it will take about 10 hours to charge a batch of AA's, but in a pinch, it'll do. Even apart from charging anything, they have little built-in voltmeters often, so you could just use them to monitor how charged a battery is. They're really an invaluable little piece of kit for anyone who plans on having access to power in any kind of a disaster. They aren't perfect, though, and there are a couple of drawbacks. But there's a couple of ways to work around them. So the first drawback is that ripple that I mentioned, that kind of pulsing high and low voltage on the output. They have specifications for how much that ripple can be, and it's not likely to damage anything. But if you have sensitive electronic devices, like maybe a radio receiver, I know my ham radio does this, you'll get like a buzzing sound in the speakers. If you've ever been listening to headphones on your phone and heard it start to whine a little bit when you plugged it into the charger, this is exactly what's happening. On a sensitive receiver, it'll completely drown out any signals you're trying to listen to. The best solution I've found is making what's called a common mode choke, or if it's used in an antenna, it's called a ballon. All you have to do is buy what's called a ferrite toroid. It's a donut-shaped piece of ferrite metal. And then you take your power cord and you pass it through the center, just kind of loop it around through the center as many times as you can. And it basically makes a one-to-one transformer, and it'll try and make both the positive and negative side of the power cord to carry the same amount of current. It helps to kind of stop that ripple that's only on the positive side. The one I made out of a little inch and a half toroid is very effective for my little radio, and it completely solved that problem for me. In fact, common mode chokes are really commonly used for this kind of thing. If you've ever noticed a power adapter has kind of a lump or a bead on the cord, that is a little chunk of ferrite in a little common mode choke. So, that's one problem solved. The other problem that you can have has to do with solar power. The boost function on these devices, where it takes the voltage and steps it up, is very inefficient with a solar panel. It will keep drawing more current out of the solar panel until the voltage goes almost to zero, and the efficiency is very poor that way. It's like 10% or probably worse. So you need to make sure that your converter is only stepping the voltage down. And the way we do this is we use the constant current function built into them. We'll just turn down the constant current mode until it's low enough that the solar panel can provide it. Unfortunately, the ones I have will turn off when they suck the input voltage down too low. So what I usually have to do is I have to turn the current all the way down to zero and then slowly increase it until I find the point where it drops off and then back off from there. It's a little inconvenient though, because if the sunlight dims a little bit or a cloud passes over, it sucks that voltage right down to zero and shuts off the device. So really, for solar panels, it's best to get the buck-only version, the one that doesn't have any boost. It only steps the voltage down. Those are a little more limited when using other DC power sources because they require a DC power source that is higher voltage than what you're trying to charge, but they do work a lot better with solar panels. If all you're trying to do is provide 5 volts for a little USB charger for your phone, a step-down module is probably what you're going to want. You're not going to find a lot of DC sources less than 5 volts anyway. So I will include a link for my preferred Buck Boost charger, Buck only charger, and a small ferrite toroid in the show notes. As always, you can always direct any questions or any feedback to generalpurposeegghead@gmail.com. I'll see you guys next week, and we will talk again about novel and interesting firearms.
I do so love it when Egghead talks preps. In fact, I think I need him to write an article for Blue Collar Prepping on how to set one of these up so that people can have a step-by-step instruction with photographs on how to do it.
Yeah, I'm not much of a prepper. I like to be somewhat prepared, but I don't get deep down into the weeds on it. The idea when he was talking about, like, oh yeah, you could just hook it up to a car battery, of just having a car battery and just doing all my needs off of a car battery, just sounds like fun.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, this was something that I had no idea existed, and now I think it's cool and I want one.
Oh, I want one too. That's why I want the step-by-step instructions. In this week's episode of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David explains the Jewish concept of Tikkun Olam, and why we should practice it at the range.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In today's segment, I'd like to talk about teachable moments and walking the walk. Earlier this week, I read an article about an interaction that an experienced shooter had with a novice at the range. While I don't know if this story is true, it still contains an important lesson. The experienced shooter, let's call him Bob, notice that the new shooter I'll call Jane had a lower-priced, lower-quality firearm and was obviously nervous and inexperienced. Instead of ignoring this person or dismissing them out of hand because of their lesser firearm choice, Bob struck up a conversation and found out that this handgun was all Jane could afford at the time. Jane had bought her handgun at the suggestion of a police officer because Jane's ex had made threats of violence against her, and Jane refused to allow him to victimize her or her children anymore. Jane had a strong impression that her ex was going to come back sometime over the next few days to make good on his threats. Therefore, she had little time to become proficient. Bob took her under his wing and spent his range time helping her learn the manual of arms for her pistol, as well as basic shooting skills. He taught her the usual stuff: loading, reloading, stance, grip, sight alignment and sight picture, trigger control, breath control, and follow-through. In addition, Bob taught her the basics on how to clear a jam and how to disassemble her pistol for cleaning. Bob urged Jane to practice as much as possible and pointed her towards some additional resources. At the end of their range time, Bob had not done any shooting himself. He and Jane had only exchanged first names and were unlikely to meet again. How many of us can honestly say that we would behave the same way in those circumstances? For myself, I can say I've done some of the same things as Bob. However, I'm a firearms instructor and I work at a shooting range. When I'm acting in my capacity as range safety officer, I often give people pointers or tips on how to improve their shooting. This does not rise to the level of being a random person at the range helping a complete stranger to the exclusion of your own shooting practice. I hold Bob in high regard for what he did that day. Reading this article also reminded me of the concept behind Operation Blazing Sword. As Erin has mentioned, this is an organization she started following the Pulse nightclub massacre to help bring together knowledgeable shooters who wanted to help and members of the LGBT community who wanted to learn. The biggest difference here is that Jane didn't seek Bob out for training. Bob saw her need and reached out in the moment. In Judaism, there is a concept known as Tikkun Olam, which is generally defined as an activity that improves the world. Bob, though probably not Jewish, demonstrated the true spirit of Tikkun Olam at the range that day. A stranger anonymously offering to help another stranger is also one of the highest forms of charity, called tzedekah in Hebrew, according to Maimonides, a 12th century Jewish scholar. This form of giving is viewed as especially beneficial since you are doing so purely for the sake of helping, not to be seen as giving by others or to create an obligation from those to whom you give. These are things that all of us need to do more of, not just in regards to firearm training, but overall. We need to keep our eyes open for those in need and offer assistance, not because we might benefit in some way, but in order to improve the world. I've asked our hosts to put some links on these topics in the show notes. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
That was just an amazing story. I hope it's true, but again, I know that it could very well be apocryphal.
It might be. I also hope it's true, because this is someone embodying what Operation Blazing Sword is all about. And just on the off chance that the volunteer in the story is listening to this podcast, contact me, Aaron@BlazingSword.org, because what you did is just completely within the spirit of Operation Blazing Sword, and I would like to refund to you the cost of your range trip, because what you did was a great thing, and I don't want you to be penalized for it.
Yeah, I've certainly been in situations like that where I've actually done the slightly awkward thing of the boyfriend taking his girlfriend for what is clearly her first time to the range, and him doing what I would say is not the best job. One of my better examples was a guy that had a Smith & Wesson M&P 40 and his very willowy girlfriend shooting it, and she was doing the backwards lean stance, and he was
the chick lean.
Yeah, the chick lean. Though guys will do it just as often. I actually don't like calling it the chick lean, because though females, I think just because of their body design and the hips and all that, it's a little easier for them to get caught doing it, but I see guys doing it as well. It's kind of just natural ergonomics, is if you don't consider the gun as a recoiling mass, just as a mass, cantilevering it is the more comfortable thing to do. But she was just getting beat up by this gun, and she wasn't holding it right, so it was beating her up even more. And I just said, oh yeah, hi, how you guys doing and all that. Hey, I've got this 22 revolver here. Do you want to give it a few shots? I think you might like it. And luckily I was able to slide it in without me insulting the other guy. And, you know, he even turned around and went, hey, do you want to shoot my gun? And I just kind of went, yeah, sure. It's a 40 Smith & Wesson M&P. Not really, but yeah, no, I've shot one of those before. You could just put a few rounds. I think you put like 5 rounds into it. And, when I inserted the magazine, I noticed there were 12 witness holes in it. And I went, you didn't buy this here, did you? No, I bought it up in Maine. I'm like, yeah, that's not a good idea. He goes, what? They were just sitting there. Nobody asked me any questions about it. Yeah, because in Maine, they're legal. It was an interesting range trip. But yeah, she ended up shooting that. And while she's shooting it, since it's my gun, now suddenly I'm kind of looking over her shoulder. And I'm like, yeah, lean into it a little bit more and, you know, get a little bit more comfortable and grip it a little higher. There you go. There you go. That's awesome. That's awesome. Cool. You have a good time. Yeah. And then I can't remember if she went back to the center fire gun, but I know for a fact that if she translated those over, she'd be feeling a whole lot better about it. So last week, in my fisking of this obnoxious anti-NRA hit piece from Vox, it nearly killed Aaron. Let's hope part 2 doesn't finish the job.
You hate me, don't you?
So last week, I covered the first part of this Vox video that claims that the NRA is a lobbying group for the gun industry, not the people.
All of this makes the NRA less of a public interest group and more of an industry lobbying group. And that's a big distinction. We're arguing about gun control with a group that makes money when people buy guns.
As I said last week, there already is a lobbying group for the firearms industry. It's called the National Shooting Sports Foundation. But the NSSF and the NRA are really on the same side, as you can't have the National Rifle Association in a nation where there aren't any rifles. And given that the anti-gun corporate lobby wants to ban wide swaths of guns, and I would argue that is the first step to an agenda of totally banning all guns, the gun corporations would be foolish to not help the group defending the rights of private citizens to enjoy their products.
They're a lobbying group. I don't know, frankly, that there's another lobbying organization that drives the debate on an issue the way that they do, and they're not doing it on behalf of anyone other than gun companies.
This is again Representative Ted Deutsch, an anti-gun Democrat representing the corrupt Broward County in Florida. I just got done saying how you really can't have the Second Amendment without the means of personal arms production, and vice versa. Where do you get your information from, Representative?
Anytime the NRA debates gun control, their priority is protecting the product to deflect attention away from gun sales.
Again, citation needed. When the anti-gun corporate lobby talks about banning guns, the NRA stands up for the personal ownership and use of those guns. It makes perfect sense. What are you missing?
They blame violence on things like video games, while blocking the CDC from actually studying gun violence.
Okay, the violent video games line from Wayne LaPierre was really stupid, and totally unfounded, especially given how vibrant the video game market is right now, and how low violent crime is. But the NRA has never blocked the CDC from researching guns. They did support the Dickey Amendment that blocked the CDC from being the propaganda arm of the corporate anti-gun lobby. And anti-gun groups like Vox, they hate that.
They blame states for not using the background check system.
Do you know that it is not federally required for states to actually report people who are prohibited possessors?
And then aggressively oppose background checks
because, quote, background checks don't stop criminals from getting firearms.
Well, given that when the NRA is actually in a debate, it's talking about new gun control laws being proposed. And it's a pretty strong argument that the corporate anti-gun lobby always wants more laws, but isn't very concerned when they're enforced or not. Or worse yet, perfectly fine with them being enforced asymmetrically. But also, they're right. Background checks don't stop criminals, because criminals generally don't acquire their guns through licensed dealers or through private sale with people who don't know their ill intent. When criminals are interviewed in prison on where they got their guns, they almost always either stole them or bought them through black market dealers or family or friends who knew they were up to no good.
Or, most obvious of all, they argue the solution to gun violence is buying more guns.
To stop a bad guy with a gun, it takes a good guy with a gun.
I love how they attack the age-old Second Amendment talking points rhetorically. Here's a thought exercise. Think of an event where a bad guy did bad things with a gun. Now think of who stopped them. I'm betting it was a good guy with a gun. Most of the time, it's a police officer. But that's because mass shootings happen almost exclusively in gun-free zones. But when they don't, it's quite common for an armed citizen to challenge the attacker.
The annoying thing is, these distractions work. A Vox study of cable news coverage after the Parkland shooting found that CNN and MSNBC both devoted serious airtime to debating arming teachers.
Gee, I wonder why it works. You notice he doesn't refute arming teachers by pointing out all those schools with armed teachers and students who've had a school shooting, as in all none of them. And given how many school systems have dissolved their gun-free zone policy or outright started training teachers to go armed, it's pretty clear it works.
The truth is, huge majorities of Americans agree on things like background checks and restrictions on assault weapons. And most gun owners, including NRA members, support things like universal background checks.
Ah, this crap again. Now, they're not outright lying here for once. There were actual polls conducted that came to this conclusion. I have no idea what their methods were, but however they were conducted, the results were absolute garbage. How do I know? Well, official polls have been conducted since the one cited. They were ballot questions for these very issues, and the numbers are in. In anti-gun deep blue states, these initiatives can pass, but generally only with a bare majority. And in states that aren't already bastions of insane gun laws, they get shot down. And this is with the corporate anti-gun lobby outspending the NRA. Given the whole point of this hit piece is to claim that the NRA is getting big money from the gun industry and not representing the people, why is it okay when the other side simply represents Michael Bloomberg and Bloomberg alone? I guess it's okay when their side does it.
The NRA knows this too, which is why they work so hard to convince their members that the government is coming to take away their guns.
And it's not? You were just talking about an assault weapons ban. And I'll note that in places like Massachusetts, New York, and California, that's getting further and further away from the 1994 federal definition of assault weapon and rapidly approaching a ban on all semi-auto firearms. Also, one of the Second Amendment arguments against universal background checks is that it could be used for backdoor registration or even a choke point for freezing all gun sales if, say, the NICS database was no longer funded Or if an anti-gun president started revoking FFLs from gun shops like President Clinton did back in the 1990s. So Senator Tom Corbin, in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting, presented a Republican-backed background check bill that would allow the citizens to log into a web portal and do background checks on each other. It could be done any place where there was an internet connection, didn't require the services of a gun shop, and took no concern of what firearm or firearms were being transferred. And this bill was shot down by the anti-gun politicians and attacked by the corporate anti-gun lobby. If the anti-gunners truly aren't coming for my guns, I haven't seen any evidence to persuade me.
It's also a smart marketing strategy. You convince people the government is coming for your guns, they'll buy more. Gun sales usually spike after mass shootings.
Except they don't note that the only time anti-gunners are pushing their agenda is after a mass shooting. This is such a set behavior that in the run-up to the midterm elections, every town was running ads talking about abortion, healthcare, and taxes, but not gun control. So yeah, people buy guns when members of the government start talking about banning guns.
In the 50s, tobacco companies formed the Tobacco Institute, a group that spent 40 years fighting against tobacco regulation.
Oh boy, now here comes a comparison of the gun industry to the tobacco industry. I'll just say I've never met anybody whose life was saved by a cigarette.
Looking back, it's bananas that anyone included the Tobacco Institute in public health debates.
Except I run a weekly segment fisking anti-gun arguments, and I'm playing Vox clips on my Second Amendment podcast. If an argument is good, it should stand up on its own. And if an argument is bad, it shouldn't be able to survive debate. And that was what happened to the Tobacco Institute. And this speaks a lot to why this anti-gun hit piece is making an argument that the NRA should be excluded from the public forum.
There's no question that having the representative for the biggest gun companies raises all of those same concerns.
Says the man attacking the NRA, but not mentioning the National Shooting Sports Foundation.
Debates about gun control only work if both sides are genuinely interested in finding a solution to gun violence. But in this case, they're not.
Given that gun control has led to increases in violent crime and relaxing of gun control laws and an increase in private gun ownership has led to record low violent crime levels, I think it's very clear that one side isn't the least bit interested in curbing gun violence. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Oh, jeez. Okay, look. I've got to be careful how I phrase this. Now, because I don't want to be perceived as taking a cheap shot at the people talking, but the person speaking for Vox had the most stereotypically homosexual voice I have ever heard. No, there's not anything wrong with that. It's just that combined with the anti-gun, combined with the panic mongering, it all, in my mind, just combined into just the so cliche, stereotypical, tired, just the panicky gay man hysterical about things. And it was just, not only can I not take this seriously, I am literally insulted on behalf of gay people everywhere. I just want to... just what a terrible stereotype he was being.
Well, after last week, us talking back and forth and you asking, why do you do this weird? And, you know, I mentioned my reasons of, honestly speaking, when you listen to their arguments, and actually next week's will be even worse.
Why?
But when you listen to their arguments, it's very clear that these people don't seek out gun owners. They don't want to understand us. They have heard enough and they understand us enough. And that's that. And so I feel that that really makes them weak in this, is the fact that they do a lot of straw man arguments and a lot of just complete and utter dishonest statements and false dichotomies. And one of the ways that we can be stronger is to hear the other side so that we know where they're coming from. You don't necessarily have to listen to it sympathetically. I'm certainly not presenting it as such in the weird audio fisks, but I am presenting their argument so you hear it. And so therefore you're getting a little bit inoculated on it and you might hear some potential rebuttals to combat the anti-gun talking points, as I say in my sign out. But Sean Sarantino of the Gunblog Variety Cast was talking about that. He said another thing that it helps is also to get you to know the scope of the problem is this guy not only doesn't, you know, want there to be guns around and doesn't want the NRA to be around. He hates them. Like, he has nothing but disdain and detest for the NRA, for the Second Amendment, and for gun owners. Like, he couldn't think less of you. And that's a pretty heavy mojo to be laying down. And I think we need to be aware of that, that no, not every person that says, oh yeah, no, I really do think that there needs to be more restrictions on an AR-15. That person isn't necessarily one of them, but they are out there. And certainly the people that are presenting the bills for the AR-15, certainly the people that are lobbying politicians to present the bills to ban AR-15s, they are one of them. And we're at war. This is not a pleasant disagreement.
Yeah, your interpretation sounds so much better. And I'm not really sure why this affects me at such a base level, but actually, no, I think I know why. It's because of my frustration with the queer community where they don't want to take responsibility for their own defense. And so it's just every example of, well, I don't want to protect myself. I have the police for that. Just all wrapped up in one package, and it just presses all of my buttons.
Well, I listened to these, so you don't have to listen to all of them, Aaron. I cut it with a little bit of weird. Your anti-gun talking points have been stepped on, so they're not toxic.
Okay, so you're like the baking powder and the cocaine. Gotcha.
Baby laxative. It's all baby laxative. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, blazingsword.org, and pinkpistols.org. And don't forget, I'll be at the convention Life, the Universe, and Everything in Provo, Utah, from February 14th through the 16th.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our wonderful music.
Well, if you've listened to one of our mag dumps, you'll know that I enjoy watching videos of pimples being squeezed for some disgusting reason that I can't really explain. And Weird listens to Vox. Our choice of gross entertainment is assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.